Today is mostly the story of Rebbe Akiva's life, where he came from, what he did, and how he went about his business. He has an amazing life story and an amazing ideas that he was able to propagate throughout the world. But really, just the story in the beginning of his life is amazing. So here's the information that people don't know about, that people sort of assume or just haven't gotten through. Rebbe Akiva, we all know, really started his life at the age of 40. The age of 40 is when he started his learning career, and that was there. But it wasn't like he was a nobody beforehand. Beforehand, he still knew things. He just wasn't well known. It wasn't there. If I don't mind, if you just leave him on a chair right by you, that'd be great. Thank you. So he was still out there, and he was still known. He just wasn't a rabbi. He was a person who was known as an Am Haaretz, which meant that he didn't know how to learn at all. He barely knew how to read, but he did know how to read just the regular Aleph Beis. He knew how to bench, and he knew how to make brachos, but that was about it. He despised with all his heart any of the rabbis that he'd ever met. That's mentioned in Pesachim, Daf Mem Tesem Abeis. He used to tell his students that when I was younger, I would bite the Talmidei Chachamim like a donkey. They would say to him, Rebbe, you should say like a dog. You should bite them like a dog. And Rebbe Akiva would say, no, donkeys break bones. He despised everything that the rabbis did and everything they said. And whenever they came out with something new, Rebbe Akiva would always blame them and say that it was completely their fault. He worked as a farmer, but it wasn't just a farmer. Back then, if you owned a farm, you didn't work the farm. You were the person that was either in charge or you were an aris, which is a sharecropper. You rented out fields from others, and you gave them half the profits while you kept half the profits for yourself. Rebbe Akiva was well known not only as just a farmer, but as a shepherd. He was a master shepherd. He was able to figure out what each sheep needed, what each goat needed, and he was perfect at trying to farm out everything that he needed to do with each one of the animals. He was perfect at figuring out each animal, where they were supposed to be and everything. And Rebbe Akiva was well known for it. That was his expertise, to which he was hired by the greatest people as being this farmer, this guy who everybody knew about. He was hired by a man by the name of Horkinus. Rebbe Eliezer ben Horkinus is one of his future rabbi's fathers. So his father had hired him as a farmhand to be able to take care of the sheep and goats in his possession. So there was one time where he was hired for 3 years straight of work. He had not gone home. Now, we all know of Rebbe Akiva having a wife and kids after he became from. The truth is, Rebbe Akiva was already married and already had a family before everything had happened with his learning. His wife, unfortunately, passed away, his first wife. But he had a child whose name was Yehoshua from his first marriage, which he had gotten married at the age of 25. From 25 to 40, while he was this farmhand, he would go home very infrequently. It wasn't just certain people that wouldn't go home. It was normally people did not travel from place to place, even though they were only days away from where they could have been. So Rabbi Akiva one time had worked for this man Horkinus for 3 years straight. And at the end of 3 years, it was right before Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, he went to his master and he said to him, Horkinus, I'd like to have my money. I'd like to go back home and be there for the Chagim, for the holidays. So Horkinus told him, I'm sorry, but I have no money. He said, okay, so could I have any pillows, blankets, anything else you have in the house? And Horkinus said, I'm sorry, I don't have any pillows or blankets. He said, that's fine. Can I have any of your animals? He said, I'm sorry, I don't have any animals. This is after Rebbe Akiva had just taken care of all of his sheep and his goats. He said, okay, then can I have land that I could sell? He said, I'm sorry, I don't have any land. So he said, is there anything that I can have that you have? And Horkinus said, honestly, I have absolutely nothing. And Rebbe Akiva said, okay. He got up and he walked home with absolutely nothing after 3 years of work. And they had, I'm sure, a terrible chag in which Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur passed by. After Sukkot, Horkinus went to go visit Rebbe Akiva. Before he was known as Rebbe Akiva, went to go visit him in the south. And as he visited him in the south, he came laden with three donkeys filled with treasures and with fruits and all these types of things. He had filled them up with everything, and he brought these three donkey loads straight over to Rebbe Akiva's house. So he brought them to Rebbe Akiva's house, to Akiva's house, I should say. He brought them in, and he knocked on the door, and he said, can I come in? Rebbe Akiva saw all the donkey loads and said, who's that for? He said, it's all for you. He brought them in. They came in. They started having a meal. And he asked Rebbe Akiva, tell me, what were you thinking when I originally told you that I didn't have any money? What did you say? He said, well, I thought you had a business deal that had come about that you had to give all your money to, and you don't have any money available. You had no liquid assets. He said, you're 100% right. What did you think when I said that I didn't have any pillows or blankets or anything? I said, so Rabbi Akiva said, I thought maybe you had sworn to give them all to the Beis HaMikdash for some type of a neder that you had made, some promise that you had made. To which Horkanah said, that's 100% correct. That's exactly what I did. What did you think when I said that I didn't have any animals? He said, I thought that maybe that the animals were in a position that you were trying to sell them to somebody else and you weren't sure if you had sold them or not, so you weren't able to give me any animals. He said, that's 100% correct also. I didn't have any money yet because you hadn't given it to me. What about the land? He said, I thought maybe you had already given over the land to your sons as a present. And he said, that's 100% true also. He said, how were you able to do such a thing? You were dan l'chafskus. You judged me so correctly. You judged me in such a favorable way. May God judge you favorably as well. That was Rabbi Akiva's story before he was from. That Gemara is brought down in Shabbos on Kuf Mem Beis, and it brings down the entire story of what happened, but it doesn't say the name. Only once the Mikubalim came by in the 1600s, the Ramami Pano came along and said that man that was mentioned in the story was Rabbi Akiva. That was Rabbi Akiva before he was well known, before he had done anything. He was still a tremendous person beforehand. So he started working for a man by the name of Ben Kalba Savua. The complicated part behind this story that everybody knows of him working for his future father-in-law, Ben Kalba Savua, is that we don't know what place in history this takes. We don't know when Rabbi Akiva was born exactly. We know that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed between the years 68 of the Common Era to 70 of the Common Era. We know that Rabbi Akiva died in 123 of the Common Era. Those are two things that we absolutely know, and those two things are there. Although I should say, as a side note, there are those that say he died in 135, but either way, right, it seems that it was around 123 of the Common Era, around the time of the Bar Kokhba Rebellion, around that time, and that he died a few years after the rebellion was unsuccessful. So that we know. The problem is how old Rabbi Akiva was. It seems that Rabbi Akiva was 120 years old. If he was 120 years old, then that means that when he started learning Torah, that was at the age of 40, he would have been there 30 years before the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. The problem with that is that Ben Kalba Savua lived in Yerushalayim at the time. It's clear he lived in Yerushalayim from a Gemara in Gittin that says that Ben Kalba Savua was willing to donate all of his money for the people that lived in Yerushalayim. It says him and another man by Nakdim Ben Gurion and another man by the name of Ben Tzitzah Keses were all in Yerushalayim and were willing to help everybody there. So how Ben Kalba Savua went to Yerushalayim when he was living outside is a little bit strange. After the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, Ben Kalba Savua, without a question, moved up north to the Galil, which is where it seems the whole story of Rabbi Akiva took place. So year-wise, we're not exactly attuned with how it works. We don't know exactly when Rabbi Akiva lived and how he was able to live that long without appearing in many history books. We don't know. That we don't know. But if we put it at somehow that Rabbi Akiva lived to the age of around 90, if we have it that way, then it's possible that this is right after the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. You can imagine that the people at the time were downcast. They never thought that anything would be built up again. The second Beis HaMikdash had just been destroyed. The people were scattered throughout the entire nation. Many of them were now living in Rome and were acting as the Romans were. They did not appear to be Jewish on the outside. Not only that, they didn't act Jewish at all. They had gotten rid of any vestige of any Jewish memory that they could have so that they could look and act just like the Romans, that they could be literally Roman people. It was a sad time for Jewish people. And Rabbi Akiva at that time had been hired by Ben Kalba Savua, this man, to be able to take care of all of his fields and his animals and everything that he had. He's extremely proud of it, Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was extremely proud of it, and he took the job extremely seriously. Ben Kalba Savua had a daughter. The daughter's name was Rachel. Her name is mentioned in a Gemara Nedarim, which you do have on those source sheets over there, that Rachel was her well-known name, and she fell in love with Rabbi Akiva. Now, it's a strange love story. This is not the typical love story. Rachel was probably around 15 years old at the time. She did not have a mother. Her mother passed away early. Rabbi Akiva was well over, he was 40. We know that for sure. So this is not the typical love story where you have two people of the same age falling in love with one another. He was at least 25 years older than her, if not more than that. And Rabbi Akiva, although he was very tall, he was completely bald. completely bald. It's why his original son from his first marriage was named Rabbi Yoshua ben Korcha. He was known as Yoshua, the son of the bald man. The son of the man who was bald, referring to Rabbi Akiva. That's what Tosa says in Shabbos on Kuf Nun Amud Aleph. But either way, regardless, Rabbi Akiva was not the most tremendous looking person, and he was known as an Am Haaretz. Ben Kalba Sabua was a big Talmud Chacham. He wanted his daughter to marry a big Talmud Chacham. He was ready to give over his daughter to anybody, and he was extremely wealthy, and this is his only daughter. You can imagine he's looking for the greatest guy that he could possibly find, and there was no one that caught her eye like Rabbi Akiva. Rachel met with him. Rachel said, my father is not going to marry me off to you. But I will tell you that if you promise to go learn, then I'm willing to wait for you. I'm willing to marry you now and then wait for you to come back in order to start a family. Rabbi Akiva didn't know what to say. There is a background behind the story. Ben Kalba Sevu had already tested Rabbi Akiva, knew him to be an Am Haaretz, and his daughter used to fight for Rabbi Akiva, trying to explain that his midos were exemplary, that they hadn't seen somebody who acted the way Rabbi Akiva did with his tznius and other things that he was able to show that showed him to be just a tremendous character, a tremendous person of tremendous worth. But nobody would look at that because they were looking for wisdom. At this time also, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had just passed away, the leader of Klal Yisrael. And nobody knew who was going to take over. Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkanis, who was Horkanis' son from before, and Rabbi Yoshua ben Hananiah were still somewhat young. They weren't old enough to take over. And there were a lot of problems with the Nasi, with Rabban Gamliel. The Roman officers were searching for the people of the Davidic line, trying to destroy them. Although Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was able to save them at first, people of the Davidic line had to hide. So Rabban Gamliel, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, they were all in hiding. There wasn't a true leader of Klal Yisrael that was able to put themselves up and say that they were ready to go. Rachel thought that this man, Rabbi Akiva, would become the next leader of Klal Yisrael if given the chance. So she went and she tried to convince him. But nothing was happening. Rabbi Akiva was sitting there and he agreed that it would be a great thing, but he couldn't stand what the rabbis were doing. He felt that the Beis HaMikdash being destroyed was their fault. There's a whole story behind that as well, that he felt that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai should never have given in to the Romans. He felt that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai should have fought the Romans physically and started a war so that at least they would be able to save some part of the Beis HaMikdash. He had opinions that were completely against everything that the Chachamim stood for. And therefore he said to himself, what am I going to do? How am I going to be able to fight everybody else here? It wouldn't make any sense to me to be able to go into these Bati Midrashas. Akiva one time was on a walk with his sheep. As he was walking with his sheep, he saw a huge rock. And this is the famous story in which in this rock, the rock that was right there in front of him, there was water that was dripping down from a little river above. There was a hole in the middle of the rock. I tried my hardest to find a picture of a rock like this. I couldn't find one. I saw one that had been purposely made, but I couldn't find any that had a regular hole inside a rock. You don't have much in there. But regardless, he found a rock that had a little hole that was just bore inside it just from the constant pressure of the water that was going on one after the other. And Rabbi Akiva was so taken aback. He turned to the other people that were there, I guess the more amateur shepherds, and he said to them, where did this come from? Who was able to make a hole in such a big rock? To which they said, how did you not realize this is the water? The water has the ability to make holes in rocks like this if it keeps going further and further and further. And Rabbi Akiva made his very first Kal Vachomer, his very first Fortiori, in which he said, well, if water has the ability to do that to rocks, then certainly the Torah has the ability to pierce my heart. Certainly it has the ability to do that to me as well. I'm not too sure I would have thought of that had I seen water falling into a rock. I probably would have said, cool, and then walked away. But Rabbi Akiva was able to look at such a thing and see that there's something behind it, there's something there. And I guess with the character traits that Rabbi Akiva had and the character traits that he was able to show to others, he was able to show people, this is something which is tremendous for me. I want to be able to do, I want to see this again and again and again. He went home. He told Rachel, yes, I'm willing to marry you. I'm willing to be married to you, and I'm willing to start a family with you. And Rachel agreed immediately. They were Mekadesh, they married each other in private, without Ben Kalba Sevua finding out about it. But Ben Kalba Sevua was able to figure it out very quickly when Rachel started covering her hair, which leads to a very interesting machlokas, unbelievable machlokas. What the point is for certain women to cover their hair after the wedding? Is it after the kiddushin, after the original engagement, or is it after the nisuin, which is after the chuppah, after that? Rabbi Kiva and Rachel had only had kiddushin at that point. If you go to a wedding, typical weddings today, if the woman is going to cover her hair, typically it only happens after the wedding is over. It only happens the next morning after the wedding, but not at the wedding itself. But if you go to more Hasidic weddings, or if you go to weddings of people that are, those who live in Eretz Yisrael who are in, more of the Hasidic enclave, you'll see that they have their hair covering as soon as the chuppah is over, as soon as they walk into the yichud room, they come out wearing either a shetel or some type of a head covering right at that moment, right at that point. Rachel started wearing it after the kiddushin, but before the chuppah. And then Kalba Sevua noticed it and realized that she had done so and said, "What happened?" So I don't know how she didn't think this is going to happen, but Ben Kalba Sevua obviously was not okay with the shidduch. He didn't feel that this was done the right way. We had shadchanim involved. You shouldn't have gone and find your own guy. That was clear that it shouldn't have been done that way. And Ben Kalba Sevua was so upset, right? Kalba Sevua was so upset about the situation that Rachel had put herself in that he swore her off of all of his property and said, "I don't want you to get any benefit from anything that I own at any time." And he said to her that, "I don't want you to come back, and I don't want you to be involved in my household." Now, this had to have been almost impossible for him himself, for Ben Kalba Sevua to do. This was his only daughter. This is not, "Well, at least I have other children, or I have a wife." Ben Kalba Sevua did not get remarried, and he had no other children. This was an impossible thing for him to do. But Rachel accepted it. Rachel said, "If you don't want to pay for it, then it's good enough for me." The line from Rachel was, "If I have to be able to pay for everything that my husband has to do in order to go learn, I'll take care of it. I'll make sure that I'm going to do that." That's exactly what she ended up doing. An amazing turn of events. They went to a city called Gamze. And although that city is not known nowadays, we have no idea where it is or where it was. It was a small, I can't even say city, that's not the right word for it. It was a small town with a bunch of huts which had one famous personality. And the famous personality was Nachum Ish Gamzu. The famous Gamzu Litova stories of "even this is for the good" was Nachum Ish Gamzu. He was the Rebbe of Rebbe Akiva who started off Rebbe Akiva's teachings. At first, Rebbe Akiva could not afford for Rebbe Akiva to go learn all day long while his wife was sitting at home doing nothing else. They finished up the marriage. The marriage was there, but he needed to go and to be able to make some money so that they'd be able to survive, they'd be able to start something before anything had happened. So what did he do? He went out to become a woodcutter. He would learn by Nachum Ish Gamzu during the day. He started off early in the morning, and he started off doing that in the day. And at night, what he would do is he would go and chop wood and then be able to sell it early in the morning for the people who were coming out of Shacharis. He would sell the wood to them, and that would make enough money for the day. He'd learn for the rest of the day, and then chop wood that night, and he'd do it over and over and over again. Rachel became pregnant. She ended up having one child, and then the next. So you can't think that Rabbi Kiva started his 24 years of learning immediately. It didn't happen that way. He stayed home with Rachel. He was working during the first couple years. He learned all day long and sacrificed. They really did not have much, but they were able to have a little bit. They had enough to be able to survive. And they had two sons. One's name was Shimon, and the other one's name was Shulamis. Shimon and Shulamis. Once he had had those two children, he sent off Yehoshua, that was his older son, sent him off to go learn by Nachum Ish Gamzu all day long, and he continued to learn. The great stories of Nachum Ish Gamzu, all of those stories of where he said Gamzu Latova, all those stories come from Rebbe Akiva. He is the one that told it to us because he was involved in each one of them. It's two, the most amazing stories about Nachum Ish Gamzu, the two that are mentioned in the Gemara in Tainis, are that when Nachum Ish Gamzu, when there was an issue with the emperor at the time, it was Trajan. If anybody knows their emperor, Roman emperor history, Trajan was the Roman emperor at the time when Rabbi Akiva was still in learning. When Trajan was coming up, he didn't know what to think of the Jews. He had just been made the emperor, and he wasn't sure what to do with the Jews. The Jews wanted to send a little bit of a message to him to let them know who they were and how, you know, they were going to listen to the Roman emperor and everything he did. In the end, by the way, unfortunately, Trajan became an extremely terrible emperor, and we even have a day that we have lost through the annals of time, but called Trajan's Day, in which when he died, Yud Gimel Adar, which used to be a Chag, now it's Tainis Esther, but Yud Gimel Adar is Trajan's Day, in which it was a good holiday and people used to celebrate right before they celebrated Purim. They had a two-day Yom Tov of Trajan's Day and then Purim. So Trajan was not a great emperor for anybody. But in the beginning of his reign, he had nothing against the Jews. So they sent a message. They said, we want to send you a gift. They got a huge box together of treasures, of pearls, of gold and silver and everything like that. And they gave it over into the hands of the rabbis. And they said, send somebody to go bring it over. They went to Nachum Ish Gamzu and said, you're well known to have miracles happen to you all the time. We want you to bring this treasure box over to Trajan to give him this gift. Nachum Ish Gamzu said, I can do it, but I need some people with me. And one of the people he brought with him was Rabbi Akiva, his young, so to speak, Talmud at the time, right? And the person that was with him. So throughout all the travels, Rabbi Akiva came with him. On the boat ride, on the way to the ship, I guess you can say, that went to Rome, as they were going, there was a huge storm at sea. Rabbi Akiva davened on the boat and asked HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem, I'm just starting off. This is the Yerushalmi that brings us down. I'm just starting my learning. Please don't kill me when I'm just starting my learning. And the boat was saved on account of Rabbi Akiva. But because it was such a stormy sea, when they got to the shores, they went to the first inn they could find, and they slept for the next 3 days. Over those 3 days, when all the rabbis, Nachum Ish Gamzu and Rabbi Akiva and everybody was sleeping, the innkeepers saw that they had brought a box, knew they were going to Rome, and they checked out the box and realized it was filled with gold and pearls and treasures and everything that you can imagine. So they immediately emptied out the box, filled it up with dirt, and then left it in the hands of the rabbis. The rabbis, knowing that they were late for their appointment, jumped up, grabbed the box, and started running toward Rome. And only halfway there, or whatever it was, did they realize that the whole box was filled with dirt, and that it wasn't filled with any treasures at all. So Nachum Ish Gamzu got up and said, Gamzu Latova, this is for the best. How a person can say that in that position? But Rabbi Akiva said to him, Rebbe, this is not a good call. If we go now carrying this box filled with dirt to the Roman emperor, to Trajan, he's going to kill us. Nachum Ish Gamzu said, this is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants from us. We'll be fine with it. And he brought the box filled with dirt to the emperor. And when they brought him to the emperor took one look at the box, looked at the dirt, and said, kill them. To which Rabbi Akiva turned to Nachum Ish Gamzu and said, I told you. To which Nachum Ish Gamzu said, Gamzu Latova. If we have to die, that's also for the best. One of the soldiers, one of the people that were around Trajan at the time, looked over at Trajan and said to him, Emperor, perhaps the Jews are giving you the same dirt that their grandfather Avram Avinu, that he had used in his wars against the four kings. Maybe this dirt can be used to be able to fight against your enemies. Now here is a little known fact in history. Trajan was always afraid of going to war. The reason why is because he knew through stargazers that he was going to die while in battle. So he refused to go out to war against anyone. The first war that he fought against was against Germanicus, who obviously was from Germany, right? Germanicus was around there. He fought against them, and no one knows how he won. This is how he won. He used the dirt from the treasure box and started throwing it. Now, according to most ways of learning the Medrash, it means that the dirt literally turned into arrows and destroyed them on the way down. The Rambam in Mori Nevuchim understands it, that they were throwing dirt at them, and they said, why are they throwing dirt at us? It must be the dirt is arrows, and they started running away, thinking that there was things hidden inside the dirt, when really it was just clumps of dirt. And Trajan won his only war that he had ever fought. That's what he ended up doing. It's an amazing story that goes through. But that's what ended up happening while they were fighting this war. The crazy part behind all of this is that once that had happened and they went through, Trajan had looked over at Nachum Ish Gamzu and Rabbi Kiva and all the other rabbis that were there and said to them, you guys can take whatever you want from the treasuries. So they went into the treasuries, they looked around, they found, you know, what they wanted, and they took everything. Obviously, they ripped up any edicts that were against the Jews. And then after that had happened, Nachum Ish Gamzu and Rabbi Kiva left. Trajan gave Nachum Ish Gamzu specifically a tremendous amount of money, that he'd be able to go back and he'd be rich for the rest of his life. Rabbi Kiva also was given a certain amount of money for allowing them to go through, and they came back to Eretz Yisrael both much wealthier than they had ever been beforehand. Rabbi Kiva at that point decided it was time for him to start learning full time. He had enough money to be able to last him for a couple years the way he was learning, the way he was living. He had no issue with it. So he turned to his wife and he said, is it time for me to go? And his wife said, of course. Rachel said, of course, go. This is exactly what we were looking for. This is the windfall that we were looking for. As a side note, Nachum Ish Gamzu then had another story. The famous story is that Nachum Ish Gamzu brought the treasures to give to his father-in-law so that he could give it to him, so that he could give it out to poor people. He didn't want anything to do with the treasures. As he brought it over on these either donkeys or wagons filled with treasures, as he walked all the way through, as they came, as Nachum Ish Gamzu came to his father-in-law's hometown, he brought it over, and a poor man came running up to Nachum Ish Gamzu and said, please give me something to eat or drink. I'm starving. I'm thirsty. I need something to eat or drink. Nachum Ish Gamzu said, give me a second. I'll get off my donkey and I'll get you what you need. But I guess he had taken a little bit more time than necessary. When he got down, he saw that the man had died right by the donkey. So he said, he felt so sad. He said to himself, I can't believe that I had done this to you. So he got down to the ground and he said, my eyes that didn't see your eyes should be blinded. My hands that did not help you, but giving you things, should be cut off. My legs that didn't run to help you should also become lame. And my whole body should be riddled with sores. And that's what happened to Nachum Ish Gamzu. A few years later, he was filled with sores. He lost his use of his legs. He lost his arms and he went blind. Rabbi Kiva came to visit him once, not even recognizing him, in a dilapidated house with his bed, all the four bedposts sticking in just buckets of water so that animals or ants wouldn't be able to climb up on the bedpost because he wasn't able to scratch himself and there was no one around to be able to help him. Rabbi Kiva turned to him and said, Rabbi, let me take you out of this house. He said, wait, take all my stuff out first and then take me out. They took all of his stuff out. Then they brought Nachum Ish Gamzu out. As soon as they brought Nachum Ish Gamzu out, the whole house fell down. Rabbi Kiva started crying. He said, Rabbi, how could this have happened to you? Nachum Ish Gamzu said, Baruch Hashem, Gamzu Latova, that this has happened to me, because otherwise it would have happened in the next world. Took on these punishments in order to not get anything for what he had done, which was questionable if he had ever done anything wrong. But it shows you the greatness of Nachum Ish Gamzu, of what kind of a person he was. He died not soon after that. A little bit after that, and Rabbi Akiva now was bereft of his Rebbe. He had him for 22 years of his life, and then he didn't have Nachum Ish Gamzu as a Rebbe. Meanwhile, Rabbi Akiva, after having his children, taking care of the parnas of his household for the next however many years, went out, and his wife gave him permission to go for 12 years to go learn straight. Now, this was not an anomaly. This was not something that was rare at the time. People gave their wives gave their husbands 12 years to learn normally. The typical way of looking at it is, if the girls were getting married, which I think was normal back then, at the age of 12 or 13, the husbands were maybe 13, 14 years old, it makes sense, I guess, that they would be out for the first couple years, that the wives would be living basically with their parents, and then there would be some time where they would go out and they would learn. Some of them would learn for 1 year, some of them would learn for 7, 8 years, some of them would learn for 12 years, but I guess that was part of the whole agreement between each other. They got married young, and they went to learn for a little bit after that, but 12 years straight. This means they did not come home. In fact, this same Gemara that goes through Rabbi Akiva goes through five other rabbis that did the exact same thing about how they came home after 12 years, and some of them even shocked their wives. That there's a story with Rav Adabar, I believe it's Rav Adabar Minyomi, who came home after that many years, after not seeing his wife, and his wife was so shocked to see him, she passed away. She shocked herself to death. To which Rav Adabar Minyomi turned to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and said, Hashem, this is the reward that such a woman gets, and she had Tchiyas HaMeisim. She's brought back to life to go see her husband. This is a sacrifice that I can't imagine anyone making. anyone making. First of all, from the wife's point of view, that she was able to take on whatever it needed to be done in the household by herself without her husband's help at all. Second of all, from the husband's point of view, of being away for that many years and not being able to, not going home. But this was the norm for most of these Talmidei Chachamim. That's what they did. They went away for that many years and that was it. I don't know why they didn't just move their wives over, but I would assume the reason why is because they wouldn't be able to learn as well as they had done. I don't know. To be honest with you, a couple years back, maybe like 10 years back, I think it was 10 years ago, I decided that I figured if my great-grandparents, and I think everyone here, your great-grandparents at some point must have known Tehillim Baal Peh. They must have. I mean, everybody knew Tehillim by heart. Everybody did. So who didn't know Tehillim by heart in Europe? It was automatic. All great-great-grandparents were like that, no matter where they were from. If they were from Morocco or Tunisia, or they were from Iraq or Iran, or if they were from... Everybody. I remember my grandfather telling me that his grandfather used to just sit there and used to mouth things at the table. When you would ask him what he was doing, he would say he would be saying Tehillim. My grandfather wasn't from... He didn't grow up that way from his parents. But he remembers his grandfather, my great-great-grandfather, as being a person that would just say Tehillim by heart all the time. So I figured, listen, if my great-great-grandfather could do it, then certainly I could do it also, right? I definitely could. So I started trying to learn Tehillim by heart. It didn't work at all. I would get past the first couple, and then I would forget what I had done beforehand. Once I got to Zion, then I had to go back to Aleph, and then I would go back, and I would try to figure it out again, and then I'd lose it, and then I'd go back. We have no ability to memorize. Like, they did nothing. And they didn't have Gemaras. Everything was memorized. In fact, the Baal HaTanya used to say, there's a famous Gemara, that if you do something 100 times, it's good. When you do something 101 times, it's great. Says the Baal HaTanya, the reason why is because 101 times was one more time than what was normal. They always went over their learning 100 times. They would learn one line and then they'd repeat it 100 times, and that was normal. So if you did it 101 times, that was one extra that made you great. That's what made you unbelievable. And the people that did it 400 times, that made you the next Gadol Ador. That was the person, because that's what everybody did. I can't do something more than twice without sitting there saying, I'm done, I'm out to the next thing. I don't know how in the world they did so. But they were all memorizing things. I would guess that 12 years by yourself, if you were really concentrating, allowed you to become that type of a person. But I have not suggested it because I like being married. I'm happily married. So I'm going to leave that as is, and I'm not going to suggest it for other people. Nonetheless, Rabbi Akiva did go for 12 years. During that time, he learned under the great Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkanus, who is the son of his old employer, and Rabbi Yoshua ben Chananya. Rabbi Yoshua ben Chananya, they both had their milas, Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua. They came from totally different schools of thought. Rabbi Eliezer was a student of Beis Shammai, the famous Shammainiks, the ones who were always trying to learn and learn and learn, but were not so much, they weren't so much people persons. They weren't like that. They were perfectly fine with who they were and how they were learning, but they weren't giving or loving. That wasn't what they did. Shammai, in fact, when people would come to him and ask to join the shir, would usually throw them away with a beam. They had to force their way in. You really had to push your way into Shammai's shir. Rabbi Yoshua was from Hillel's line of thought. Hillel's famous love everyone, that type of a method. That he was like that. It was sort of like having an Eish HaTorah rabbi that's helping you versus a mere yeshiva type of rabbi. He was just like, you want to be in my shir? Why do you think you're good enough to be in my shir? Like that type of a method of Hillel versus Shammai. And that's really where Rabbi Yoshua and Rabbi Elias were coming from. They were a perfect contrast in the Beis Medrash. They got into fights all the time, which allowed everybody to understand more and more. Because I know it sounds strange, but arguments when it comes to Torah learning, when it's all based on the Torah itself, helps grow the Torah. It's called Yagdil Torah V'Yadir. It allows things to become understood more. Because if you just say a line, maybe people can understand it in different ways. But if you have other people dissenting opinions that are going up against you, and you have one person saying this and the other person arguing that way, you can understand how two ways of looking at the same idea and try to understand both methods. What are the good things about this method and the bad things about this method? And that's what they had. Rabbi Eliezer, at one point, I mean, it became so tremendous that Rabbi Eliezer argued so much just about a little oven, about a certain oven, whether or not they needed to purify it or not. Was it something that was able to be moved or not? It's called Tanur Shalachnoi, that Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkanus said, if I'm right, the carob tree outside should prove it to you. Now, I don't know if you've ever had carobs before. They're not good. They're not ever good. Buxers are also what they're called. They're still not good. No matter what the name is, they don't taste good at all. But carob trees were outside the Beis Medrash, and one of the carob trees picked itself up out of the ground and walked 400 mil or whatever it was to the other side to show everybody that Rabbi Eliezer was right. To which Rabbi Yeshua said, you can't bring proof from a buxer tree. That's not a good proof. So he said, fine, if I'm right, then the river outside should flow in the wrong direction. The river started flowing upstream instead of downstream. To which Rabbi Yeshua again said, that's not a good proof. You want to prove me in the Beis Medrash? Give me from a Gemara, but that's not a good enough proof. To which Rabbi Eliezer said, the walls of the Beis Medrash should prove that I'm right. The walls started caving in. The walls started caving in. Rabbi Yeshua yelled at them and said, what are you getting involved with this? So the walls stopped where they were so that they wouldn't go all the way down, but they wouldn't go all the way up. They stayed as they were, and that Beis Medrash is called Deshuf V'Yosiv. In Bavel, apparently it still exists, but I've never been to Bavel, so I'm not planning on it either, so I don't know where it is. But that's the Beis Medrash of Shuf V'Yosiv. That's what it was supposed to be. And finally, Rabbi Yosef says, if I'm right, let a bas kol from Shemayim come down and let everyone know that I'm right. And a voice came down from the heavens that said, what do you want with Rabbi Eliezer? He's right in everything he says. He's correct in everything he does. To which the bas kol came down, Rabbi Eliezer, everybody heard it, and Rabbi Yeshua said, we don't listen to bas kols. We don't need such things. Again, it deals with what we have in front of us. And since the Beis Medrash is all in agreement like me, then you're wrong, Rabbi Eliezer. This was the I'm sure there was a regular Tuesday in the Beis Medrash of Rabbi Eliezer versus Rabbi Yeshua, right, in which that was the method of learning, in which Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua would go up against each other, and Rabbi Akiva was the Talmud Mufak, which means the best Talmud of both of them. He learned by both Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua, took on everything that he could from both of them, and eventually became a Rebbe that took on both of that. It took on both methods. The method of Beis Shammai, of knowing when to say no, and Beis Hillel, of when to say yes, and when to be able to help other people. Unfortunately, not all of his Talmidim understood it the same way he did. We know that during Sfira, during those times between Pesach and Shavuos, 24,000 Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva passed away. Of those 24,000 Talmidim, many of them lacked what the Gemara calls kavod, honor for one another. That they did not show proper respect to one another in how they were acting. And that was the Shammai Torah showing through. That they were arguing, but instead of arguing in the way that Rabbi Yeshua and Hillel taught, to argue with respect for one another, they argued in a way that showed disrespect for one another. And for that, they weren't allowed to remain. I mean, to think of those numbers of 24,000, that would be literally like taking every yeshiva, every person who's in yeshiva today, and pretty much... maybe you'd have a little bit less than that, but 24,000 Talmidim, that's what Rabbi Akiva lost. They lost an entire generation of Talmidei Chacham. It took 12 years. Rabbi Akiva came back. He went back to go see his wife. He had promised, and he brought back with him 12,000 Talmidim. 12,000 Talmidim. That must have been quite a sight. As he came near the town, his wife was in an argument with one of her neighbors. The neighbor had said, your husband has ditched you for the last 12 years. He's not worth anything. You should think about divorcing him and starting to go back to your father. Your father's a rich man, go back to your father. She said, if I would give him another 12 years, if he would take another 12 years, I would make him go back and learn for another 12 years straight. To which she said, obviously, Rabbi Akiva heard it. He didn't even walk in. He turned around and went right back to yeshiva. And Reb Chaim Shmulevitz says that shows that, number one, what she was thinking and what he was thinking, they understood each other so well. Rabbi Akiva understood that all Rachel wanted was for him to learn and for him to continue to grow and to be the greatest person that he could be. And Rabbi Akiva understood that if this is what Rachel wants, then I need to go back. 12 years straight is not 12 years straight is not like 6 plus 6. And 24 years straight is not like 12 plus 12. He knew if he stopped, went and said hello, even if it was just, hi, I'm going, even if it was just that, it would not be the same as going 24 years straight. And he went right back to yeshiva. Ruckel eventually must have found out about it or heard about it. I can't imagine 12,000 people come to your town and you don't hear about it. And eventually, people found out that that was all 24,000. I mean, eventually, Rabbi Kiva came back after 24 years with 24,000 Talmidim, and Ruckel only knew that that was there. Obviously, everybody made up. It's like a good story at the end. Then Kalba Sivua said, I'm so sorry, I didn't know, I had no idea. Had I known, I never would have. But Rabbi Kiva lived an unbelievably charmed life, all because of what his wife was able to do for him, and what Rabbi Kiva himself was able to do, willing to be able to give up for everything else. Rabbi Kiva had another two children after that. There's unbelievable stories with his children. There's unbelievable stories of how Rabbi Kiva grew up with Hadrian in his backyard, with Hadrian, the new emperor, and Turnus Rufus, who became the governor of Eretz Yisrael, right there, what he ended up doing. But that's just the beginning. The beginning of this story, and really the end of our story for today, is how Rabbi Akiva was willing to push himself and how his wife was everything to him. That if it wasn't for her, there would have been absolutely nothing for Rabbi Akiva to be able to have done. We'll stop with that heavy, great...